Music video games are among the world's most popular, earning billions of dollars, selling to gamers who delight in shredding through a song by Jimi Hendrix or Aerosmith. NPR's Netta Ulaby says the company that makes Guitar Hero is tweaking that franchise with a new game that comes out tomorrow.
The game is called DJ Hero, and it's about as true to actual DJing as Guitar Hero is to actual rock stardom. Jamie Jackson is creative director of Freestyle Games, that developed both DJ and Guitar Hero.
It's not about you being a DJ and simulating. That wasn't the idea. It's about having fun and feeling like you're controlling the party. So all the music is pre-made by our DJs.
Meaning it's a pre-mixed, pre-sampled, pre-beat-matched assortment of popular tunes. Freestyle developers worked with about 20 DJs to figure out how to turn turntabling into something playable on an Xbox. It works like Guitar Hero, but instead of that plastic guitar, you get a fake turntable and a fake little mixer, while a funky DJ avatar struts, cuts, and scratches on screen.
He is enjoying himself.
Robert Carter is a DJ who plays nationally under the name DJ Cousin B. By day, you'll find him including audio for NPR's website. I asked him to play DJ Hero.
Takes some getting used to, but then again, this is a game.
Freestyle Games recruited a few illustrious DJs to add cred.
It's your boy, DJ Grandmaster Flash. I'm going to be a professor.
Okay, you got Flash on here, okay. So it's official.
Now let's talk about tapping.
I never had Flash teach me how to DJ, so let's do it.
We decided to pit DJ Cousin B against a gamer, NPR intern Brian Reardon.
You're overthinking it. You just got to move it. Just moving it back and forth.
Yeah, I'm overthinking it. I'm at an NPR, not the club.
DJ Cousin B was experiencing the same problems some guitar players have with Guitar Hero. Real skills don't translate. They confuse you.
That's weird. Because you normally don't scratch with just one finger, so it's really strange, but okay.
When Freestyle Games first developed DJ Hero, creative director Jamie Jackson asked regular people what they thought DJs did.
99% of them put one hand to their ear and the other made a scratching sound and kind of went, wicka, wicka, wicka.
See, I mean, I don't know anything about turntables, and I'm sure, like I have no idea what this, I've never known what guys are doing when they do that.
Gamer Brian Reardon still utterly destroys the DJ in this virtual battle. Robert Carter is a fabulous DJ in real life. He's not fabulous at scoring points in the game's glamorous industrial nightclub.
You are just stinking up the joint.
They just booed me.
Oh, you didn't even get one star.
I didn't get a star, man. They booed me.
Is there anything about this that's like actual DJing?
DJs fantasize for an environment like this. You have about 30,000 people out there going crazy. I mean, it's everybody's reacting. No fights out there.
DJ Cousin B, a.k.a. Robert Carter, says this game is perfect if you want to one-up a DJ.
Say, man, like, you know, I think you would be nice at DJ Hero. Let me check you out. And you just kill him.
Still, Carter plans to get the game for his little 8-year-old nephew. In a few years, he says, he'll teach him how to DJ for real. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Audiences around the world have a chance to see Michael Jackson's last performance. It's a documentary made of rehearsal footage from the huge show he was planning for London when he died. The film is called This Is It. Despite the finality of that title, we can expect to see a lot more of Jackson's work, as Nate DeMeo reports.
Kenny Ortega had worked with Michael Jackson for 2 years developing the This Is It stage show. And when its promoter came to him and asked him to turn footage of that process into a film, he hesitated. His friend had just died.
I didn't feel that I'd have the creative objectivity to step into an editing room and sort of face this material so quickly.
But he says as he sat watching the footage, he felt like he didn't have a choice.
I was there. I knew what the story was. This was sacred. And that it sort of was my responsibility to continue forward with the journey.
The result of that journey, that several months spent in a dark editing booth, is now opening on 11,000 screens all over the world.
There's the man.
There's Michael.
Woo! The man is here.
We're all here because of him. May that continue with him leading the way.
This is the moment. This is it.
box office prognosticators project good returns for Columbia Pictures, the movie studio that placed a $60 million bet on Ortega's documentary. Prognosticators of the earnings of dead celebrities, yes, such people exist, project that the next 2 years will be incredibly lucrative for the Jackson estate.
You're talking about the level of the Beatles and Elvis Presley and Michael Jackson and Frank Sinatra. These are the icons of the icons in the pop world.
Jeff Jampol manages the Doors and Janis Joplin. Not used to manage. He manages everything. He approves and rejects licenses. He times album re-releases. He tries to get the artists on the covers of magazines. And it can be a perilous business.
Literally, I could ruin in an afternoon what it took these guys 30 years, 40 years to build.
And then there are all the other people who the official gatekeepers have no control over.
As his friend, I do feel a certain responsibility for his image, of course.
Rabbi Shmuley Boteach is one of the many parties outside of the official Jackson circle who will be profiting from Jackson's image. He recently released a book drawn from recorded conversations with Jackson. Boteach calls it a raw look at a complicated man, even though he says that might frustrate the people in charge of maintaining the Michael Jackson brand.
Their principal objective is to ensure the financial integrity of the estate. I'm not sure that they have made it their priority to ensure the integrity of Michael's image.
All we can do is put our faith in the family and in the estate that they're going to be smart and selective.
Kenny Ortega says he worries about what will happen to his friend and collaborator now that Jackson isn't here to guide his own career. But he says he's been encouraged by what he experienced during the process of getting his documentary to the screen.
Do I have complete faith and utter confidence? No, I don't. I don't. You know, but I can say that the experience that I've been through has shown some promise.
It appears that decisions about how, and importantly, how often, Jackson's image and music will be used will primarily be made by two men, John McClane and John Branca. Both are longtime veterans of the music industry and the Michael Jackson industry. The Doors manager, Jeff Jampol, says the two men have an incredible opportunity in front of them. With most artists, the big fear is going too big, licensing too many products and diluting the brand through overexposure. But this is Michael Jackson.
I think you have an obligation to do things on a huge superstar worldwide level. In the case of Michael Jackson, I don't think you can go too big or too exposed.
In other words, the King of Pop is dead. Long live the King of Pop. For NPR News, I'm Nate DeMeo.
They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms in your corner. We visit with a diverse group of parents each week for their common sense and savvy parenting advice. Halloween is now around the corner, and maybe, like me, you've gotten tired of buying new costumes for the kids every year and are trying to convince them they really want to be Batman again. Well, if you're recycling Halloween costumes, you can consider yourself an eco-mom. Okay, there's a bit more to it than that. And to hear about it, we turn to Lynn Caldwell and Corey Caldwell-Lipson. They're the authors of Celebrate Green, Creating Eco-Savvy Holidays, Celebrations, and Traditions for the Whole Family. Also joining us is Tell Me More parenting contributor Jolene Ivey. Welcome to you.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Corey Caldwell-Lipson, tell me, what is a green Halloween?
Well, actually, we started an initiative called Green Halloween in 2007. And the idea was to see if we could get people excited around the idea of being a little bit healthier, being a little bit more earth-friendly, while keeping all the fun and great traditions that we remember as kids. And we weren't really sure how people would respond to this idea. It was a little bit of an experiment. And what happened was amazing. I mean, people came out of the woodwork to be involved in this initiative. And we're heading into year three. And we have neighborhoods, schools, churches, individual families who are doing all kinds of things.
Lynn Caldwell, is part of this basically just dialing down on the consumerism?
That's definitely a part of it, because when you think about the basics of going green, they really are reduce, reuse, recycle. So definitely you want to be thinking about what you buy, when you buy it, whether it's necessary. Is there a substitute? Do you already have something that you can use? So certainly when you're talking about costumes for Halloween, most of us don't need to buy costumes. We can make them.
Lynn, are there, what, like special energy-saving little pumpkin light bulbs or something? Can I find that in the CVS?
You sure can. You might want to check with Corey on that one. She's our lighting expert.
Yeah, you know, lighting is a really great question, because it's a big part of holidays, especially around Halloween. and incandescent lights that are kind of the typical type holiday lights that are available use a lot of energy, and they also burn hot. So there's a safety issue with them. LED lights are a really great option, and there are so many fabulously colored and decorative lights that are now available on the market. And they burn cool, and they also use 90% less energy than incandescent lights, and they will last a lot longer. You can also find little LED lights that you can put inside your jack-o'-lanterns if you don't want to use candles.
Now, wait a minute. Isn't a candle more eco-friendly than that?
Yep. And I was just going to say that for those families who want to use candles, which we, you know, my mom and I personally love, we choose beeswax candles, 100% beeswax. And not only is it more sustainable than paraffin, which is oil based, but it burns more cleanly. And of course, you're supporting the honey and bee industry, which is a great thing to do as well.
Okay. Jolene Ivy, a green Halloween. Does this work for you?
Well, what we basically do is we recycle our decorations every year. Just yesterday, I was pulling out all the tombstones out of the attic. And, you know, we bring them out to the front lawn. It takes us, you know, 10 minutes to set them up. So we do that. I do want to get some more cobwebs this year. They're probably not eco-friendly, but I love those things. And, of course, we recycle the costumes. I mean, every child has been a ninja. And whenever someone decides they want to be something else, I'm like, no, you really want to be a ninja because I got the costume, kiddo.
And does that cause a little bit of drama there, Halloween night?
In the end, they just want to go out and trick-or-treat. They're not real picky.
Corey Caldwell-Lipson, how can parents get schools maybe involved in this whole effort?
On our website, greenhalloween.org, we actually have a downloadable action kit for teachers now with all kinds of tips for decorating and for incorporating some healthy and eco-friendly ideas into the school celebration. And a lot of schools now are not doing Halloween per se, but they're doing harvest or other kind of fall things. And of course, one of the best ways to bring the fall into your home or classroom or any other event is to go outside and go into nature and see what's out there and see what you can decorate with. Kids love to go on, you know, natural treasure hunts and to haul in their finds and to help construct some decor.
Lynn, I understand there is now a way to put all that leftover Halloween candy to a non-fattening use. What is a post-Halloween candy composting party?
Well, just what it sounds like. You get together with your friends, you bring that average of 10 pounds of candy that the child brings home and hopefully doesn't eat all of it, but maybe wants to get rid of some of it, and instead of just trashing it where it goes to the landfill, you can compost it and bring it. Everybody comes together, unwraps the candy, puts it in a compost bin, and what's neat, too, is a lot of wrappers now. People, I don't know if you've seen this, but there are some really cool things that people are making out of wrappers. And they're making purses and wallets and picture frames and all sorts of things. So one of the suggestions is, after you've had your composting party, go on Craigslist or Freecycle and offer your wrappers. And you'll be surprised. Somebody may just snap them up.
Jolene, you going to have a composting candy party?
No, but I am available if you have any leftover chocolate. You can drop it at the Ivy's house. We have five boys. We're ready for you.
Yeah, I don't think my colleagues here would appreciate missing the annual leftover candy. Corey, what are three ways parents can save money by going green?
Well, our number one tip is on the treats and treasures. When whatever you're giving out, no matter what you choose to give away to trick-or-treaters, just give one. We've become such a supersized nation. You know, when I went trick-or-treating as a child, I remember getting one or two pieces at each door. And now kids are getting handfuls, thus the 10 pounds of candy that they're taking home. You know, you'll save money. You're going to save on the resources. The kids are going to consume less and it's going to create less waste. It's better all around. And another thing to do is to compost your pumpkins when they're finished using them, instead of putting them into the landfill, to compost them. And the last thing I would say is taking care of the decor that you have. Wrap it up, keep it out of the elements so that you have it you know, in great shape for next year and you can reuse it.
Even if that little spooky sound doesn't work anymore. Corey Caldwell-Lipson and Lynn Caldwell are the authors of Celebrate Green, Creating Eco-Savvy Holidays, Celebrations, and Traditions for the Whole Family. They join me from member station KUOW in Seattle. And Tell Me More's parenting regular is Jolene Ivey, and she joined me here in our Washington studio. You can find out more about green Halloween ideas at the Tell Me More website, npr.org. Ladies and moms, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now, as if candy composting isn't enough to keep in mind, here's something else to consider this Halloween. It's never fun when your creative and witty costume falls flat or just gets you shrugs from the partygoers. But what happens when your outfit isn't just not funny, but it's perceived by some as downright racist or sexist? Joining us to talk about this is Carmen Van Kerkhove. She publishes the blog Love Isn't Enough about race and parenting and the blog Racialicious about race and pop culture. Hi there, Carmen. Welcome to Tell Me More.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's start with a recent post on Racialicious. Your blog editor, LaToya Peterson, wrote this: Halloween is an exhausting time for us wee anti-racist critics. When everyone else gets to dress up and have a good time, we wind up at home either sifting through online images of people dressed up as racists and growing more bitter and gnarled by the minute. That's a depressing picture. Can you explain how it is that a night that's supposed to be fun can really cause such anxiety for some?
Well, if you think about it, you know, Halloween costumes are often based on the things that we as a society either have anxiety about, we see as taboo or abnormal. So there's a reason that not a lot of people dress up as, for example, a middle-class white man who's an insurance manager and has two kids and a dog. That's not an interesting costume because it's quote-unquote normal. And so a lot of the costumes out there will deal with sex, with violence, with death. And then also you see a lot of costumes that show sort of marginalized identities, you know, people of color, different cultures.
Give me a list. Give me some examples of someone. You open the door and there's a kid in what? It's going to make you feel weird.
Oh, boy. Stereotypical Mexican with a big poncho and a big mustache, geisha, and then any number of sexy blank ethnicity. So sexy harem girl, sexy Native American, sexy, you know, as one of our bloggers laughed, said sexy Shaolin monk. Any of those are going to definitely raise an eyebrow for me.
But now, is a lot of this, you know, is it racism or is this just simple ignorance? People don't get it.
Well, I think this is something that, you know, a lot of people just haven't thought about. And, you know, quite frankly, I myself, not too many years ago, dressed up as a Native American, you know, just because I had a fringy suede vest and a fake suede skirt. And I thought that would be, you know, an easy and cheap costume to do. So a lot of people just haven't thought about this. But I think once you think about how, you know, this, you know, the kind of implications that this has, then I think it's important to you know, change your behavior. You know, one of the bloggers that we linked to on Racialicious wrote, for example, when did it become okay to reduce the diversity, language, culture of nearly 500 different indigenous tribes into a tacky costume of cheap suede, colored feathers, plastic beads, and fringe? So I think one element is that it's kind of insulting if you're from a culture to see that very complex culture boiled down into this caricature.
Well, you know, we put out a call for comments on our Facebook page, and Brigitte Brent wrote back, do blacks have a monopoly on pimps, prostitutes, rappers, inmates, or maids? I think some people definitely overreact to Halloween costumes. Is it overreaction?
It depends on your perspective. You know, I think that one of the problems with dressing up as someone from a different background is that you get to sort of live as them for a day, walk in their shoes for a day, but with none of the institutional oppression that they have to face. So, for example, you can go as a so-called gangster from the hood with baggy jeans and, you know, whatever else are the accoutrements of that particular costume, but you don't have to be racially profiled by the police. You know, you can go as a harem girl or an Arab sheik, and you don't have to be racially profiled at the airport. And so it's really a way of getting to dress up, but, you know, you deal with everything but the burden.
You know, one of your bloggers wrote in about how when she was a little girl, she was so excited because her mother dressed her up in a beautiful Native costume from her home country, Trinidad, and she got to wear makeup. And she arrived at school so proud and excited, and then all the kids thought she was Aunt Jemima from the maple syrup bottle, or the little slave girl in the movie Roots, and she was crushed. Do you have advice for parents?
Well, I would say that that example shows how much we are really affected by the stereotypes that we take in, so that even if we see a costume, we immediately categorize it into something that we're familiar with, you know, the Aunt Jemima, the slave girl. And so I would say to parents, you know, it's not about staying away from race altogether. I mean, you know, I'll give you a few examples of costume ideas that I thought were great that played with race but didn't necessarily go into being offensive. One blogger that I know who's a Chinese-American guy, and he has a daughter, and she was about, I think, 4 or 5 years old, and last year he dressed her up as an underage Chinese gymnast. So he put a fake birth certificate on her back claiming she was 16, and that was funny, you know?
I think we have to leave it there. Carmen Van Kerkhove is the publisher of Love Isn't Enough, a blog about race and parenting, and Racialicious, a blog about race and pop culture. She joined us from NPR in New York. And that's our program for today. I'm Jennifer Ludden, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.